welcome to episode 29 of Girls on Pop. I am your co-host, Rain Antunes, joined as usual by fellow co-host.
I am Ashley Lynch.
Happy Mother's Day, Miss Ashley.
Happy Mother's Day to you, Miss Marina.
Oh, thank you. We are recording on Mother's Day. We make time for you guys all the time. We don't take breaks ever.
Because today we are your film mommies.
That is so good. I love it. Film mommies coming to you. And Ashley, if people want to get in touch with film mommy number one, the best of all time, where can they find you?
You can reach me on Twitter at Ashley Lynch.
And you can find me on Twitter at The Marina. But let's jump right in since we have lots of stuff to talk about and pretty much the largest movie. Is this now the biggest movie in the universe? Like, I'm not 100% sure where Spider-Man fits into the conversation at this point. Is that from last year?
It is now that, like, Spider-Man's no longer part of the conversation. It's come, it's gone, it's on home video. It's like, and so what's next? It's the next Marvel movie. It's the next biggest thing.
I haven't of course,
what the box office is, but I assume it's like all the box office.
I think so. I did see a headline yesterday that Everything Everywhere All at Once just hit 40 million in the specialty box office, which is super impressive. But yeah, I'm pretty sure Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, that's what it's called, right?
Yes, that is it.
I can't believe I didn't. I only wrote down Doctor Strange. I'm like, I'm sure I can remember what this movie is called. And then, of course, I promptly forgot it was Doctor Strange and something.
There was this account I saw the other day that just got, like, totally ripped apart. But they had, like, this incredibly horrible take where they were trying to compare Doctor Strange to Everything Everywhere All at Once and how, like, Doctor Strange is going to crush it financially. And it's like, yeah, but Doctor Strange opened on a record 4,400 screens simultaneously, and Everything Everywhere All at Once opened on like 200 screens. So do the math.
Right. Okay, but so let's talk about Doctor Strange. So I unfortunately haven't seen it yet, but I mean, I think it's important that it's so timely, and I know that you saw it, and I think I know how you feel because I did see a tweet from you.
Yeah, well, I was excited for this movie for two reasons in particular. One, I love the Marvel movies. I find them incredibly enjoyable. I don't think any of them are bad. Some of them are better than others. And I genuinely have a very fun time with them. And I go and see them all when they come out. So I was looking forward to this movie for that reason. The other reason is that I am a huge Sam Raimi fan. Massive from way back in the day. I was that kid in high school that all the other kids looked at and said, why are you watching these Evil Dead movies? You're weird. And then the rest of the world kind of caught up with me and rediscovered that the Evil Dead movies are actually amazing. So it's kind of nice to see Sam Raimi having a moment, both like hardcore horror fans and also the Spider-Man Raimi fans all coming together going, oh my God, we're getting more Sam Raimi. And I feel so vindicated in my Lost in the Wilderness fandom of Sam Raimi back in the 90s. Anyways, so I was excited to see Doctor Strange for that reason as well. And honestly, the movie does not disappoint. It was very fun. It was a wild roller coaster. A lot of people are calling it Marvel's first horror movie. And maybe someone the other day said that I'm just like really jaded when it comes to like genre stuff because I'm like, you know, I'm such a horror nerd that like for me to call this horror is just like this is PG-13 horror. You know, this is horror for people who never watch horror movies and can't tolerate horror movies. So it's got some dark stuff in there, but it's the sort of dark stuff that Sam Raimi is an expert at handling the tone of and making it fun. So it just plays like a fun adventure with, you know, some creepy stuff thrown in. And there's a lot of really neat creative sequences and elements in this movie. And maybe it's because I avoided most of the advertising around it, but I was honestly surprised at how many times the movie surprised me that I didn't know where it was going. And it took me on a fun ride that I just really dug. Is it the most incredible movie ever? No. But it was definitely a really fun movie and one I'm looking forward to seeing again. Loved it.
I generally really like the Doctor Strange. Okay, so I love Benedict Cumberbatch. I think he's fabulous. So, you know, the fact that he's in the Marvel Universe is kind of fun to begin with. And really, I just kind of like the character because he's, I don't know, he's a bloody magician. He's got a fun cape. The movies don't take themselves too seriously. And the visual style of the film, the first one was really, really interesting. And I kind of like this concept of like bending time and whatever else. But mostly I really appreciated that. Like there was so much, like the movie just never took itself too seriously. And I'm kind of hoping that the second one is the same because Sam Raimi. I don't know. I'm looking forward to catching up with this. So I'm excited to hear that it's fun and that it's been a while since we've seen a Sam Raimi film, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, like the last film that he did, was it the Oz movie that he did?
It might have been.
Yeah, it's mostly been, he's been doing producing,
yeah.
And this, of course, is like, because it's going to make all of the money, and people are so very excited, and the film's obviously playing well for majority of people. It's, I think a lot of Sam Raimi stuff is now, like, very much on the table, which is nice. I know that Universal has been talking about possibly doing a Darkman Legacy sequel. Sam Raimi has talked about it. Universal has talked about it. Liam Neeson said he would be down to do it. And so that tells me that they've actually approached Liam Neeson as like, hey, do you want to do this movie? Which tells me they're in serious talks about like Sam Raimi doing another Darkman movie, which I think is very cool.
Sam me too.
Wanting to do like another kind of like small nasty horror movie for like $20 million, you know, something like Drag Me to Hell. That's exciting because I freaking love that movie and I love his Evil Dead movies. We're gonna get more Sam Raimi, it looks like, in the future from this, and to me that can only be a good thing.
That's really exciting. So, and I will probably catch up with Doctor Strange in the next 2 weeks, and I'll pitch in with some other thoughts the next time we talk. Yeah, but generally,
I tried very specifically to not be spoilery about what I'm disclosing about it, because A, you haven't seen it yet. B, a lot of people listening might not have seen it yet, and there's some specific stuff in there that's like, oh, you know, big reveals of certain kinds, like. I went in not even knowing who the actual villain of the movie was, and I was kind of surprised at that. I don't know how much of that gets revealed in the trailers because I haven't looked at them.
No, I honestly don't know who the bad guy is either. And I mean, we did try to get tickets to the Friday night screening and then to a Saturday early morning screening. And the seats that were left were like so terrible, even we would sit there. So we're like, okay, I guess we're going to wait a week and watch it sometime next week. So that's kind of the plan. But I was kind of bummed that I wasn't able to go with you guys. Next time.
Yeah, I don't know. People are just very excited to be going back and, you know, seeing Marvel movies. I think Spider-Man was very much like, it was kind of like an out-proportioned response to Spider-Man, I think. How excited people got for that and how much money that movie made. I think that was more just like a people wanting the pandemic to be over and to be going back and enjoying like a big dumb Marvel movie again, and the fact that it was Spider-Man in this big event film, it was like this perfect kind of combustible moment for everyone to just like lose their shit at the theater. And I think that's why Spider-Man was like as unpredictably successful as it was. And I honestly think Doctor Strange is benefiting from that as well. I think it's a lot of that sort of like leftover sentiment where people just really want to go back to the theater to see a movie like this.
Agreed. Though I got an email, I think it was Thursday from, and it was very early in the morning from like Landmark Theaters going, buy your tickets now for Top Gun. And I'm like, fuck this. Take me to the Cineplex website. I wonder if those IMAX tickets are on sale. And I was not the first person to buy them, but I was very close. So I'm like, I texted Dan. I'm like, I'm buying tickets to Top Gun opening weekend IMAX. Nice. We're so there.
The only thing that bothered me about Doctor Strange, and this is a very sideways nitpicky thing, is the theater at first was like screwing up the 3D projection because we saw it in 3D. And they quickly fixed it and restarted the movie. We were only like 5 minutes in, so we just like started over again. They got it fixed. However, it also meant that the Avatar 2 trailer that was at the front of it was also projected wrong, and I did not get to see that again. And I was, like, looking forward to seeing the Avatar 2 trailer, and I could barely watch it because the 3D was screwed up. So it's like, I still haven't really seen that trailer.
I haven't. I've only heard about it in passing. I'm very excited to finally see that, but it's going to be awesome. It's going to be awesome.
Yes. Yes.
All right. So then I panicked at the beginning of the week because I'm like, I have not watched any movies in like a week, so I need to watch some stuff. So I kind of
watched.
I kind of did. I had a bunch of stuff on my desktop that I wanted to get to, so I kind of powered through a bunch of it. But I wanted to start with something that I actually watched on Netflix because it had been on my queue for a while. And I actually put this on my queue mostly because of Alison Kamen, the director. She directed Jagged, which is the Alanis Morissette documentary that she did for HBO last year, which I really, really liked. And I highly recommend for anybody that's like a music fan or grew up in the 90s and is into like rock music, because it's an interesting encapsulation of the period and her staggering rise to stardom and then the crickets that followed. It's a really great documentary, but that's basically why I watched White Hot, The Rise and Fall of Abercrombie and Fitch. Because honestly, I have very little interest in Abercrombie and Fitch. I never shopped there. It was this like kind of weird ass store that I always walked by, and you could like hear the music and smell the cologne from like walking too close to the entryway. Which kind of actually ties in beautifully to the documentary and how they kind of delve into this exclusive club that they tried to build with their stores. And it's basically about the rise and fall of the store. I mean, I think they're still around, but they are not nowhere near the pinnacle that they were in the like mid 90s, where it was everywhere. It's just a solid documentary. It's nothing to write home about, but it's certainly interesting is really all I can say. Talk to me about Wormwood Apocalypse, because I actually meant to watch this. Then I remembered I haven't actually watched Wormwood. It fell by the wayside. I have it somewhere because somebody had told me I had to watch it. I haven't seen it.
I feel like you can watch the sequel without watching the first movie and catch up just fine.
But I kind of feel like at this point, if I don't watch the first movie now, before I watch the sequel, I will never watch it.
Yeah. The appeal of these movies is basically just the base conceit, which is, you know, pretty fun, which is like, you know, zombie apocalypse type movie. But it's basically like, what if Mad Max, but zombies? So it's very much a Mad Max apocalypse. It's an Australian film. So it has that vibe, and it's all these like people in like tactical battle gear with their like pieced together out of scrap metal fortresses that they've made because of the zombie apocalypse, and society is completely broken down. And, you know, it's like they're just like the baddest of the bad of the toughest are surviving in the zombie apocalypse. And they have like their, you know, souped up armored vehicles that they've handcrafted and that sort of thing. And they're just survivors. And in this world, the zombies, for whatever reason, they basically like breathe out a kind of combustible gas as a result of being zombies, which they learn in the first movie, they can actually turn into a kind of fuel. And they start to fuel their vehicles with zombies, essentially. And so that's where this movie picks up. It picks up with, you know, just like this is the world we're existing in, where zombies are kind of like a source of fuel for the ragtag people that are surviving the apocalypse. And then you have some characters that are essentially like hybrids between like they're part zombie and part human. And they have this drug that they take that basically like calms them down when they, you know, that they have to take regularly to keep from going feral. And a bad guy that's basically just this underground psychotic bad scientist guy that's experimenting on people and zombies and trying to find a cure, but also maybe just trying to find like a super drug based on the zombies. And he's just like, he's experimenting with all sorts of nasty shit. And it's just like, it's more of the same, honestly. And it's done really slickly. It's really fun. I really dig the vibe of these movies. Directed by Kia Roche-Turner, and he did the first movie too. And it is what it is. It's a very inconsequential type of film where it's like, okay, I saw that. That was fun. You know, forget about a week later, but there's something there. It's like they created this like neat little world that's like fun to visit. And I was kind of surprised when another one of these came out. It was just like, oh, we're doing Wormwood again. Okay, awesome. I'm down with that. You know, if we get another one of these in like 5 years, it's like, cool. I'll watch another Wormwood movie. These are fun.
That's awesome. It kind of almost sounds like Mad Max meets zombies.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Okay, so I'm going to move this one up the list because I may need a mental break this week, and that's going to be my mental break. Wormwood 1 and 2. I love it. I watched The Contractor. I didn't watch it on Amazon Prime, though I think it's streaming on Amazon Prime. It's an Amazon film. I basically watched this for the cast alone. It stars Chris Pine and Ben Foster, and Kiefer Sutherland makes a very small appearance. And it also stars Nina Hoss in a side role. And it's basically, I mean, we've seen this movie before. Chris Pine and Ben Foster play ex-military guys that are now private contractors. Chris Pine, like Ben Foster has been in the gig for a while, and Chris Pine's character is still in the army and is dishonorably discharged for reasons and then needs money. So he takes on a job that goes sideways. It's not exactly what he expected. So, you know, we've seen this before. It doesn't really offer anything new, but it is really aptly made. And really, Chris Pine is really awesome. He's just generally great. And it's worth seeing just for him. He's really good. And he's aging quite well. Mm-hmm. I do really like Chris Pine. And he's like this, I don't know, he just kind of melts into roles. And I don't think he really gets enough credit for the work that he does. And I mean, Ben Foster is amazing. And I hadn't seen Kiefer Sutherland in a while. So it was nice to see him sort of pop up for a very brief moment. The only thing that I'm kind of baffled by is they have Nina Hoss and they don't really use her for anything, which is super disappointing because she's like a spectacular actress and she really needs to be in more stuff. So, I mean, I wouldn't say run out and see it, but it's like a really like fast paced. I think it's almost 2 hours long, but it doesn't really feel that long. It's a really kind of like fast paced action movie that mostly takes place, you know, out in the field. I'd say it's worth checking out. I did rather enjoy it. So, and it's streaming on Amazon Prime. So that's The Contractor.
I haven't heard of this one, but there's the other Chris Pine movie that's on, came out on Prime called All the Old Knives, which is like a spy thriller, which I haven't
I'm going to have to add that to my list as well.
Chris Pine is just doing a whole bunch of Amazon Prime stuff, apparently.
I'm okay with that. If they're on the if Amazon is on the Chris Pine game, I am there. I feel like
we're all just waiting for like Chris Pine to be like in that incredible movie that uses him perfectly, because he's always like good in what he's in, and he's very likable.
Yeah, but
he hasn't been in anything where you're like, well, that is one of the most. That's a great one of the best movies I've seen this year, sort of thing.
Yeah.
We're still waiting for that Chris Pine movie to happen.
I agree 110%. 110%. In the meantime, I'll just keep watching his, you know, sort of mediocre run-of-the-mill movies because they're still okay. If Chris Pine is in it, I tend to think, okay, it's going to be fine. And, you know, this cast with Chris Pine and Ben Foster, I'm like, you could really not go wrong here. And you don't. It's not particularly memorable, but it's also not garbage. It's just a solid film, a solid thriller. The Sadness.
Yes. This is a movie I've been looking forward to because I've been hearing so much about it. This is a, I want to say Korean film. I'm pretty sure it's Korean. And it's basically a zombie film. It's 28 days later, essentially, like rage zombie sort of thing. The sort of like origin that gets alluded to is it's like they're going the pandemic route, whereas essentially they imply that it's like an offshoot of like some form of rabies that affects humans. And you know, it very much kind of like you can see the allusions to, you know, coronavirus at the very beginning of the movie and the way people are reacting to it. And very quickly after the start of the film, you've introduced a couple characters. It's like shit just like goes off the rails. I've gotten to a place for quite a while where I'm just kind of like tired of zombies. And, you know, ironic that I have two zombie movies in my list this week. But I've always felt that like zombies needed to just go away for like 10 years and then, you know, come back in like some sort of reimagined form. But zombies have never really got away, especially with like Walking Dead on the air. It's like it's been zombies for like the last like 25 years. You know, it's been nonstop. And at a certain point, I'm just like, I'm burned out on zombies. And every once in a while, still, there's like a Train to Busan that comes along where you're just like, holy shit, here's a zombie movie that I genuinely love and was giving me something that I didn't expect. It was showing me something new. And that's the sadness. The sadness is very much like, it's a zombie movie where I'm just like, holy shit, I've never seen anything like this. And in particular, this movie is not going to be for everyone. I will warn everyone right off the top, unless you are a hardcore horror fan, the sadness is not going to be for you. Because this is a particularly vicious and graphic and hard movie. The very first thing that happens in a movie is this old lady comes into a restaurant, takes a pot of boiling oil and pours it over a guy's head as he's screaming in pain and his skin is bubbling. And then she starts clawing the flesh off his face. That's how the movie starts. And then it escalates from there. So if that's not the sort of thing you can do, and I totally get it, if that's not you, sadness is probably not for you. For people who are like me, the sadness is very much your bag. And the sadness was very much my bag. It is an incredibly intense, hard little ride that I absolutely loved. And I think it's a great film.
All right, moving that one up the list. Sign me up. I love it. I love it. God, I feel like I've been watching crap in comparison. So I watched The Outfit. And mostly I watched this again because of this cast, because, you know, we really can't go wrong with Mark Rylance. So this is directed by Graham Moore. It's his debut feature. He wrote The Imitation Game, and he's mostly like our writer and producer. So this is a 1950s set gangster movie with Mark Rylance as a tailor whose shop is kind of like a hub for ill activity. And he kind of gets caught in the middle of this turf war between Johnny Flynn and Dylan O'Brien. Dylan O'Brien's father is like the mob boss, and Johnny Flynn is his right-hand man. But he and, you know, the son are kind of fighting for leadership, and then shit just goes sideways in the shop. And Zoe Dutch is, because I guess you need a woman. Like, I don't know. She kind of just shows up and is awesome, but her character has very little to do. And the whole movie takes place in this one shop. Like, they never leave the space. So you see the opening scene is them going into the shop, and then the entire thing takes place in the shop. So I meant to look to check to see if this was shot during COVID, but I would not be surprised if it was because of the limited setting. That said, I kind of thought it was like most of it kind of just plays out as this kind of just very passive film. I mean, it's really well written and the performances are great, but it's just kind of boring. And then in the last 15 minutes, it just completely sells itself as something else. It's still a mob movie, but like the twists that it takes actually elevate the movie out of like mediocrity into something a little more interesting. So I would say it's definitely worth your time. I mean, the performances are already good, but yeah, those final like 10, 15 minutes completely change the perspective of the film, and it gives you a different kind of take. And I think that if you were to watch it a second time after you see it the first time, there might be something else to it. I haven't had a chance to see it again. I probably will at some point because I think my dad would really like it. And I'm curious to see how it plays after you kind of know how it ends, because it does. That finale is very impressive. Very impressive. And it's a good looking movie. Like, it really is a good looking movie. And like, and as much as Zoe Dutch doesn't really have a lot to do, her character, and there's another character that's also played by a woman, are actually kind of integral to the story. And they're actually given more to do than just look pretty. So it does do some interesting things. For a while, it just kind of plays as this very kind of forgettable mob movie until it's not. So I would say if it's even vaguely of interest, I'd say check it out. It's totally worth your time. Cool. Yeah. Okay. The Lost Leonardo. I have no idea what this even is.
Yeah. So this is a movie that I ended up seeing like the trailer for incredibly randomly, just like stumbled across it online and watched the trailer. And it just like was instantly like captivated by the premise. Like, oh, that sounds really cool. And so I've been like waiting and waiting for this one to like finally come out so I could see it. And here it is. And it, Lost Leonardo, is a documentary about, the story is essentially about an art hunter who discovers what he believes is a missing Leonardo da Vinci painting, in fairly poor condition, but he believes he discovers it, buys it for a few $1,000s. They hire a top-notch restoration artist to try to repair the painting. And word starts to quickly circulate about this painting, and its authenticity is constantly dubious, with people in the art world both equally dismissive of its authenticity and also eager to authenticate it at the idea of there being a new Leonardo da Vinci painting to sort of like enter the world. And it turns things upside down in the art world for quite a while. And it also, by virtue of following this painting through the art world, we also sort of get to see like how the art world on an economic level works. We're going through the buying and selling of paintings. We're going through the high-end auction houses. We're going through the world of art restoration and what that means. The people who evaluate and authenticate and basically give value to paintings, and also the people who just use paintings as a commodity that cannot be taxed and store them in Freeport so that they can use them as collateral to get capital to use for other business ventures. And it ends up being incredibly interesting and insightful documentary as this painting changes from hands to hand. And it's like right now, actually, it's like it's not 100% known who's in possession of the who's in possession of the painting right now. I think they believe it's in the UAE right now, basically just being like held as like political capital, so at some point they can just like trot it out and go, well, here's this Leonardo da Vinci painting, so forgive us for our atrocities. You know, so it's that's kind of where it ends up. Not that that's a giant spoiler or anything like that, but it's just like the journey through this world I found absolutely fascinating, because so much of it I know absolutely nothing about. And the documentary has the exact right tone of both kind of inquisitiveness and awe, but also skepticism about how far up its own ass this entire world is of itself. So it does an equal part job of like lifting it up and educating you about it, but also deflating it and saying, here's why this is all kind of bullshit.
I
found it endlessly fascinating.
Is this on VOD or is it streaming somewhere?
It's on VOD currently. Basically available for rental and sale on digital platforms.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. Yeah. I kind of love those documentaries.
The whole thing ends up playing like a potboil thriller, but the real value is just like the documentary into the world of basically art restoration and high-end art auctions.
Nice. Okay, adding that one to the list. That sounds really interesting. I've been keeping my eye on this for a while. I don't even really know why. It just kind of interested me. The King's Daughter. This is directed by Sean McNamara. Stars Pierce Brosnan, Kaya Scodelario, and William Hurt. And Pablo Schreiber, which might be why I had it on my to-watch list. So this has been sort of kicking around for a while. I think it was supposed to come out last year. It never came out. And I don't know if it was like due to the pandemic, but it's...
I feel like I've been seeing the trailer for this thing
for years. Exactly. And I think it was maybe meant to come out years ago and it didn't, which it never bodes well for a movie, like ever. So this is... it's all Chinese money. So they clearly paid people a lot of money to be in this thing. And that's always kind of also troubling, because it's not always a good marker for quality. That said, the visual effects, of which there are a few, are pretty good. The production design is excellent. And honestly, the movie is a bit weird. Like, it's a fairy tale story. So Scodelario plays a young woman who has been sent off to a convent to grow up. She doesn't know her parentage. She ends up being the princess. Pierce Brosnan plays the king of France, and he has this master plan to live forever in order to keep the kingdom together. And like, it's this weird mix of a tradition and non-traditional like dress and stuff. He's passionate with music, and he brings people to court all the time to discover new music or to create new music. And his daughter happens to be musically inclined. So he brings her to court without telling her who she is, and then shit happens. So it's this fairy tale, but the key conceit is that, he has a scientist that basically tells him that they've found these creatures under the water that they think can help the king live forever if they can catch one. Turns out to be a mermaid, and then stuff happens. They catch the mermaid, and then stuff goes wrong. It's a really charming fairy tale that I haven't seen before. I have no idea if it has any basis in classic fairy tales, but it's fine. Like, I actually rather enjoyed it. I thought it was really charming, and it was really sweet, and it was a little bit romantic, and it was just nice. I mean, I wouldn't write home about it, but it's okay. I really have nothing else to say. I just wanted to say that it wasn't the... Okay. Yeah, I kind of felt like I had worked myself up to this idea that it was going to be so... Yeah, and I was kind of expecting it to be a total train wreck, and then it wasn't. So that happened. And I know that I don't think you have any other movies, so I'll quickly just touch on one more that it. I do have one more that I watched on Netflix. This is Choose or Die. With Asa Butterfield and Iola Evans. And it is a horror movie about these kids that are playing this video game that has consequences in real life. And it kind of turns, it's pretty brutal. It's quite violent. I really enjoyed it. It turns into a little bit of a mind fuck towards the end because you're not really sure exactly what's going on. And I did rewatch the last 15 minutes twice because there was like the mechanics of how the game operates in real life. I think I got confused on them somewhere in the middle, and I don't know if that's the fault of the movie or my fault. So I can't really say it was all the movie's fault. So I did rewatch those last 15 minutes to kind of figure out, like, does this fit into this, what they were setting up? I think it does. It's pretty good. It's pretty decent, and it's pretty violent. It has some really great moments. And can I say, Asa Butterfield is pretty great. I haven't seen him in anything in a while, but I was, because I think he's doing a TV show now. I think he's doing a TV show, but I haven't seen him in anything. So it was nice to see him in a movie. It's pretty good. I'd say, you know, it's nothing to write home about, but I really love the concept of choose or die. And I think it was well executed. So I would say it's worth a look.
I'll have to add it to the list then.
So let's talk about some TV. And you didn't put it on your list, but I can only assume you've been watching Moon Knight.
Yes, I thought about putting this on my list because we did talk about it last episode. But yes, we finished Moon Knight. Got to the last episode this week. So it's I really dug it by the end. I was a little worried about the show in the beginning. I think I probably touched on this last time that like it started strong and then it felt like it was meandering and I wasn't really all the kind of like mystery of the plot and the bad guys and the plans and the Egyptology it's interesting enough, but it wasn't really capturing me. I wasn't like, ooh, I have to find out what happened. You know, it was like, I could take it or leave it to a certain degree. And what I found the most captivating was Oscar Isaac's performance and Oscar Isaac's performance with himself. Cause he's playing basically, you know, dual roles. And what I found was that in the last two episodes, 5 and 6 in particular, which really kind of dive deeper into his character and become the sort of solidification of everything about his character up to that point, is some of the strongest stuff in the entire series. And I ended up loving the show by the end of it because of those last two episodes. It completely turned around how I was feeling about everything, and I suddenly got way more amped for the entire series and this character. I'm kind of wondering if I go back and rewatch it in a way where I'm not watching it week to week, if I might actually like dig some of that stuff a little bit more. I'm not sure. But yeah, I ended up enjoying it a lot more than I thought I was going to.
I'm with you. I did enjoy it more than I thought I would, but you know, that final episode threw me for a loop and I'm still not quite sure how I feel about it. I'm 100% with you. Oscar Isaac is still the best thing about that show. And it really is for me, the key reason why I kept watching it. But man, yeah, that final episode, I'm not sure how I feel about it. I really don't. And I really don't know how I feel about the post-credit sequence, which to me didn't explain anything, didn't help me in any way. I'm even more confused than I was beforehand. And I'm just like, okay, I guess there's a third one. Like, I don't know. I don't know. I thought it was fine, but I actually liked everything up until that credit sequence. And then I was like, what the fuck? Really? You have to throw that in there? So I don't know. I'm assuming we're going to get a season 2. So
yeah, I'm guessing so too. At least I hope it continues. I think it's an interesting enough character.
I agree. At least for another season, I'd like to see Oscar Isaac on a regular basis. Yes. Talk to me about Tokyo Vice, because it's one that it's high on my watch list and I haven't had a chance to get around to it yet.
Yeah, this was one that I was quite interested in seeing, just mostly because it's produced by Michael Mann and he directs the first episode. And I love everything Michael Mann does. Especially in this type of genre. I guess the downside is he only directs the first episode. And while the first episode is very Michael Mann, it's like exactly what you would expect from that sort of thing. After that, when other directors start taking over, it's like, okay, well, it's like, it feels like a step down, even though I'm still digging it and liking it. But the premise of the entire thing is basically is based on a true story of what's the dude's name? Jake Adelstein, who is a journalist who basically lived in Japan and became one of the first non-Japanese people to work at a Japanese newspaper. He just really wanted to be a journalist in Japan, and that's what he did. And in his desperation to try to succeed in that system, stumbled into, but also just through tenacity, worked his way into trying to cover the workings of the Yakuza in Tokyo. And so the show ends up bouncing around between several different worlds. The best way that I can sort of describe the show is it's like Black Rain, like the old Michael Douglas, Ridley Scott movie, if it weren't just like an 80s action thriller, but instead were a modern day drama. That's what this feels like. So you have several different worlds that this is bouncing in between. You have the world of the journalism and chasing the story through Jake Adelstein, played by Ansel Elgort, who is a little bit of a charisma black hole, but I think maybe that works for him here. And then you have the another character who is another basically white girl who's living in Japan and working at a hostess club and is in that world, where she's basically just trying to amass a whole bunch of money to open up her own club in Japan and is essentially hiding out. And she's very like connected to various, you know, dark elements of the underworld of Japan through that job. And then you have Ken Watanabe as this kind of hardened police detective who, it's a really interesting role because he's sort of like, you almost expect him to be playing that like, you know, he's that been everywhere, seen everything police detective. And you almost wonder, it's like, okay, is he like the corrupt cop because he gets along with all the Yakuza? And no, he, amongst the Yakuza, he's considered the incorruptible cop. That's how they refer to him. But he gets along with the Yakuza because he knows his job isn't to like bust them for whatever crimes. It's to stop even worse things from happening. So he's constantly trying to just essentially keep the peace and understands that that means letting them do what they do as long as it stays within a certain purview. They understand that. He understands that. And Jake Adelstein doesn't really understand that and is provoking the situation, which causes a lot of things to happen. And then you have a few characters that are inside the Yakuza and you follow them and their journey to sort of like work up the ranks inside the Yakuza as well. So you're bouncing through all throughout these like various little side stories that are constantly like ping-ponging and colliding with each other. And it's actually really interesting. It's a very interesting world that is made probably more interesting by the fact that this is a true story. And, you know, Jake Adelstein did report on this stuff. So this is, you know, dramatized or not, this stuff is legitimately, is legit what's being shown in the show, which adds it, gives it a level of authenticity that makes it more interesting than it would otherwise. And the cast, you know, Ansel Elgort aside, or even just including him, is really good. You especially see it when he's like paired with Ken Watanabe, where Watanabe is just like, emanates charisma, just like with just like an arch of an eyebrow, the man can own the screen. And then you put him next to Ansel Elgort, it's like he's just like fill. It just like amplifies how good, how effortlessly good Ken Watanabe is in everything he's in, and he's great in this as well. So I really dug this show. I think it's definitely worth a watch. I think my only complaint, if there is one, is I hope to hell they do a second season of the show, because the first season doesn't really have any kind of conclusion. It's more like it just reaches a point and they're like, well, now the real work begins. It's like, okay, please, please more.
Give me more of the real work. I want to see.
Yeah.
Oh God, Ansel Elgort. Charisma Black Hole is right.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Sad but true.
So I finally finished We Crashed, which is on Apple TV Plus. This is the rise and fall of WeWork, based on the real story and the work done on the Wonderly podcast of the same title. So Jared Leto stars as Adam Newman and Anne Hathaway stars as Rebecca Newman. And it's basically like literally the rise and fall of the company from the early years right until he was ousted. It's really interesting. It's really sleek, very well made. The performances are great. They both come across as hugely unlikable characters, particularly Rebecca Newman. She just comes across as this, and I mean, I have no idea if this is true or not. I don't know her. I don't know any of these people from anywhere, and I've never followed them closely enough to know whether the show took any liberties with at least even what you see as far as a public persona. But she just comes across as this wannabe crybaby, spoiled, wannabe star that just never really gets her way and eventually just gives into the fact that her husband is always going to be the center of attention and her role is basically to support him. And it's both creepy and sad, but mostly just like irksome. And they're both just, they both come across as these two people that are just not likable in any way, shape, or form. So I don't know. I'm not shocked that WeWork crashed. There is a reason why that company failed so miserably. I mean, they're still around, but not in the way that I guess they had ever planned. The series is quite good. And I mean, I think people have made comments already on the fact that it's Jared Leto behind all of this makeup. You can barely tell it's him again. But he's good. Like, he's really good in the role. The show is great. I don't really have anything bad to say about it. They're just very unlikable people. So I don't know if it's everybody's cup of tea, but it's interesting to see the inner workings of the tech industry and how companies that are valued at billions of dollars can come crashing down around you. And there is some interesting insight into how fabricated that entire universe is. So I think it's interesting to see for that. I'm sure a documentary out there that does a better job of it, but as far as like wrapping it up in a drama series, this actually does have some interesting insights into Wall Street that might come as news to some people. And there's some great characters in here, so I'd say, you know, if it's even vaguely of interest, it's definitely worth checking out. I rather enjoyed it.
I suppose it was probably inevitable as the entire tech industry sort of moved into this like VC capital venture arena of just like funding all of these various startups, and how a lot of them end up just being like spoken mere fraud or start with the germ of a good idea, but obviously they can't get there and they have to like keep it's the fake it till you make it. And some people just keep faking it and never make it. And eventually that faking it just becomes outright fraud. It's not aspirations. And there's a whole slew of shows like this now. We've got the WeWork one. We've got The Dropout, which is based on Theranos. We've got the one based on Uber, which I guess the difference is in that case, Uber is a company that is still operating and to a certain degree thriving, even though they have continued to thrive at a loss for like the entirety of their existence. It's just like a flood of VC capital hoping to eventually, you know, drive all of their competition out of business so that they can start making a profit. And that's just kind of the world as it is for these types of companies now. So I suppose it's not a surprise that we're getting shows about all of these companies.
Well, what's interesting here, I think, as far as like insights into how these companies operate is the fact that, you know, like Uber, WeWork was basically operating at a loss right until their IPO. And you get a real interesting look at how it's not necessarily just the VCs that are to blame, but it's the banks as well. Because once the IPO was announced, the banks like they came in like vultures, and that's when the numeration started getting like out of hand. And I think in the end, it was the company was said to be worth like $46 billion, when in fact that number was completely false. Like it was there. There's an entire scene where you see them. You see Adam talking to some of the bankers saying this isn't high enough. And quite literally on the spot, they bump it up another $1 billion. And it's like, how is this like real life? Well, it's fucking not, which is the problem. And I mean, in the end, it's where we ended up, right? I mean, the company is still around. They're now successful. They are a business that's making money, but they were never valued anywhere near what, you know, the original offering was going to be. And as a result, the only people that got themselves into hot water there was SoftBank, who lost their fucking shirt, and the employees that had shares that ended up being valued at nothing. So you had like thousands of employees that, you know, for years had been told, you know, your shares are going to be worth something. It's why we're underpaying you. And all of a sudden the IPO happens and their shares are still worth nothing. Or very, very little. So those decades of work are basically worthless. So it is also like a, I don't know, for a show that's made to entertain, it actually does.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it like everyone else that lost as well? Because essentially their model was just acquiring as much real estate as possible, which mm-hmm. drove up real estate prices in every market that they went into.
Yep.
Which means that we all suffer as a result of what we worked in.
Well, and that's one thing that they don't talk about, right? I mean, it's mentioned in part, like in passing, because at one point, you know, they're hemorrhaging money so badly and they've already thrown Adam Neumann out of the company. But, you know, they're trying to realign the focus and the drive of the company. But they've already signed leases for like thousands and thousands and thousands of square feet of office space that they have to move ahead with, because otherwise that money's already lost. Mm. So they're just digging their hole deeper. But you're right. It does have an effect, and it had an effect on real estate prices everywhere. I think that in a way that has somewhat righted itself, because COVID has closed so many offices that there is now a glut of office space. I'd be curious to see what that model looks like now, because I actually think that work share spaces are probably in a better position now than they were pre-pandemic. Because I mean, I know that like in the office that I work in, we've downsized and we actually looked at a co-working space because we didn't need 2,000 square feet. Right. Mm. So but that's like besides the point. All I'm trying to say is that the show, for something that's made to entertain, actually tackles some really interesting ideas and concepts within like the larger industry as a whole. So, and it is fun to watch. Like it is really entertaining to watch these two people be miserable human beings to each other. Mm-hmm. That's essentially the reality of it. And it's now that I think they finished airing all the episodes. So the whole thing is available to stream on Apple Plus. So
finally dive into it.
I think it's worth it.
I watched one of these like downfall of the fraudulent company shows, and I felt like I needed a break before I dove into another one.
Yeah, yeah. This one, I don't.
In between the WeWork one and the Uber one.
I haven't watched the Uber one. I didn't even know it existed, so I'll have to look that up somewhere. But
yeah, that one's called, was it Super Pumped?
I'll have to look for it.
It's got Joseph Gordon-Levitt in it.
Oh, okay. I'm going to have to look for it because I do really like him. So yeah, We Crashed, recommended from me. Talk to me about From, which I've never even heard of.
Yeah, I heard this one mentioned on another podcast. Shout out to Colors of the Dark. But this is a show I hadn't heard of. And that's because it's basically on this little streaming network called Epix, which I guess Epix was owned by MGM, and now Amazon owns MGM. And so now the first season of this show has found its way onto Prime, because Amazon now owns it. So I think Epix is probably going to go away and all that's going to get folded into Amazon. But I've heard this is getting a second season, and I sure hope it does, because I genuinely really dig this show. I think it's very cool. So the best way to describe this show is it's very much a like horror mystery show. And the best way to describe it is to say that it's basically like Lost meets Salem's Lot. So the base premise is there is this little dilapidated like 1950s town in the middle of nowhere. And by middle of nowhere, I mean literally nowhere. Everyone who arrives at the town inexplicably is incapable of leaving the town. Anytime they try to like leave and drive outside of town, they suddenly find themselves looping back and arriving back at town. No one's been able to leave this town. So everyone who lives in this town has arrived there against their will from all different places in the country. No one even knows where this town actually exists on a map. And where, you know, who built the actual town, who can say? This is all part of the mystery. And as if this wasn't horrifying enough, that base premise, at night, all of these creatures come out of the trees and descend upon the town, and the creatures, they all look like people. And they will just stand outside your window or your door and ask to be let in and talk nice to you. And if you open up the window, then like the teeth and the claws come out and they literally just like rip you to pieces. And so all the townsfolk, when night comes around, the sheriff goes around ringing a bell and everyone has to get inside their homes. And they all have this talisman that they found that they've put up at the front door that keeps them from entering the house. And after that, the only thing is like you have to let them in for them to get in. And once you open up a window or a door, that's it. They're just going to like flood in and eviscerate you. And they come out at night and they disappear in the morning. And so the people are basically like scrounging whatever materials they can. And the only materials they have is stuff that basically comes to town the way everyone has arrived to town. They have medical supplies because an ambulance at one point ended up in the town. Those are all the medical supplies that they have. They grow food every once in a while, you know, whatever food people are carrying with them. If like, you know, a shipping truck of some kind full of food arrives, that's how they get food, you know, and they're just trying to survive. And they're also trying to figure out like the mystery of where they are, how they ended up there, how they can get out. And you come up with like, oh, well, it's got to be this, or it's got to be this, or it's got to be this, or it's got to be this. You know, it's like, oh, they're all dead and in a waiting room, or, you know, and this is purgatory, or they're all in a coma, or this is like, you know, or this is like someone's like petri dish community, you know, project that they created to sort of study how people operate, sort of thing, or it's aliens. You know, you come up with like your various explanations, and the way that the show has sort of spun out in just the first season of the show, and I don't want to spoil too much about some of the things that happen, which just, I have no damn clue where this thing is headed or what the actual explanation is, but they do constantly like reveal little tidbits. You know, it's absolutely wild. So I'm really digging this show. I hope that the acquisition by Amazon does not like end this show, because I've heard it's getting a second season and I really want to see where the show goes. And I think it's really good. I think people should check it out.
I'm going to be spending some time on Amazon this week because the second season of The Wilds has also dropped. So I know what I'm watching for the next couple of days from and The Wilds. I like it. I like it. We maybe should have finished with you, because the last show that I want to mention, and I kind of just want to mention it in passing, is Star Trek Picard, which wrapped up season two this week. And I really loved season one. I thought it was really good. They introduced some really interesting characters and some great acting talent to go along with it. Like Alison Pill is fantastic, and Santiago Cabrera might be the best introduction to a Star Trek universe that I've ever seen. Like, he was just so, so good. And then for season two, they kind of did this thing where like Star Trek kind of it's not just Star Trek, but a lot of franchises will do this. They will go back to like the past to like figure something out and or reintroduce something familiar that the fans love in order to move the story along. And in the case of season two of Picard, they did both of those things. They went back to the past and they reintroduced the Borg. And I have mixed feelings about both of those things. In the end, I don't think it was a particularly strong season. I didn't love it. I'm actually more disappointed by the fact that we're not going to see any more Captain Rios because they left him in the past. And that irks me so badly because he is legitimately my favorite thing. But there are moments in the show that are in the season that were quite good. And the whole Q storyline was really fascinating. So I don't know. There's both good and bad. I think in general, it was a very blah kind of season. And I'm curious to see what they do for season three, which I understand to be the final season. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. I do like that it's kind of like they're very short seasons and the stories are like very encapsulated. But I was kind of expecting more considering how good season one was. So it was a bit disappointing. But we'll see what happens when they eventually do season three. So that's my blah. Star Trek Picard didn't really do it for me. We should have finished with you from Sounds So Much Better. And that's all I got.
It has less Patrick Stewart, so there
is. Yeah, that is. There is that. There is that. There is that. And we also watched the first episode. I wasn't going to mention it, but I think it's worth mentioning that I did watch the first episode of Star Trek. I think it's called Discoveries. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what they're calling the new one. I don't remember now off the top of my head, but it's the new Captain Pike show with Anson Mount returning to the universe. And the first episode was quite good. So I'm curious to see where they take this particular Star Trek, because they're in the Star Trek business. We've got lots of Star Trek shows. They're all of varying quality, which is what gets me. But I'm curious to see where this one goes. I still don't know. I had this conversation with Dan the other day because we're not huge Trekkies. I prefer Star Trek to Star Wars, but I don't consider myself like a Trekkie by any means. But I am curious to read where these fit into the timeline, because to me, it seems like particularly this new one sits outside the timeline, or the movies that J.J. Abrams did sit outside the timeline. I'm not 100% sure which is which, because I'm very confused about how these characters all know each other. And I'm unwilling to rewatch those Star Trek movies because they were not that great to begin with. But that's just my own qualms. But
it's right now that Star Trek is the thing that's like keeping Paramount Plus going.
Pretty much that and Halo. I have Halo thoughts, but I'm gonna wait until the next time we talk, because I think by then the season will be either over or almost over, and I'm still like two episodes behind. But I will just say this: so good, so good. Yes, I'm really enjoying it.
I've heard no one talking about this show at all.
I know. This is the thing.
I haven't seen a single episode myself.
And I am certain they're not going to do a season two, and I'm going to be deathly disappointed. And I'm actually thinking Dan the other day downloaded the Master Chief Collection for me to play on Xbox. Mm. He's like, trust me, you should at least play a little bit of this. I'm like, okay. It's going to be terrible. I just know. But we're going to try it anyways. But yeah, but I'll have more thoughts on Halo next time we talk.
Okay.
Because by then it'll be done and I want to see where it's going. But
maybe you will sell me on the show.
Okay, so this is going to be my goal, to try to sell Ashley on watching Halo. Mind you, have you played the game?
I've played a couple of them.
Okay.
Really. I don't know. I never really fell in love with the games.
Okay, so we may have varying, because I don't know anything about Halo, like nothing, and well, I think that's helping my enjoyment.
Anything about the world of Halo from playing the game?
Oh, okay. So this is what I don't know.
Just like generic soldier dude in helmet fighting generic alien dudes that shoot back, and it's like, yeah.
There's more than that in the show. So, okay.
Yeah.
We're already on good ground. But we'll come on. This is it. We've given you a lot to watch, lots of options. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with some more.
I expect you to watch all of it.
All of it. The mothers say, watch it all.
Your film mommies say, watch more movies.
This is now what I'm going to hear in my head a week before we record. Okay, the movie mommy was going to want me to watch more stuff, so let me clear my queue, or at least try to. You know, every once in a while, I think I should have, if I had more time, I'd want to do the, oh God, what is his name? Oh, I'm not going to remember now. The Korean director who says he watches a movie every day before he does anything else. His name is escaping me. I can't remember now. It'll come to me and I'll link to it. Cause he did say that in some interview. He's like, I watch a movie every day before I even like get my day started. And I do think every once in a while, I'm like, okay, well, I can get up at 6 a.m. with Dan and watch a movie before I start my day. And then
I had time for that.
Well, this is it. I'm like, even if I get up at 6 a.m., I have shit to do at 6 a.m. So, whatever. Okay, but come on by etcpod.ca. Check out the links to all of the stuff we talked about today. We'll link to all of it. And in the meantime, you can continue the conversation on the Twitters. Ashley, how can people find you?
I'm at Ashley Lynch.
And I am at The Marina. And don't at me Halo stories, okay? Somebody actually sent me a message about Doctor Strange, which apparently is a spoiler, but because I haven't seen anything about the movie, I didn't know it was a spoiler. I kind of was just very confused. I looked at it again this morning. I'm still very confused. So please.
That's the best way to be.
It is the best way to be. It is what it is. But okay, we're already going off. So until the next one.
Insert catchphrase here.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.